All right, everybody, welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson. In case you're tuning in for the first time ever, shame on you. But hopefully you'll stick around. The show covers all things innovation, ideas, creativity, always with a little skew towards business, and we try to have a little fun while we're doing it. And today, this guy, you're just a nice guy.
I am?
Yeah, you're like genuinely nice, which is, it's rare. But hello, Moron Surf, how are you?
Thank you, very good.
I like when you say your name. Can you tell people who you are?
So I say Moron Surf. And people ask me if it's Moan or Molan, and I hear the same for every word they say. So.
yeah, well, you have a very distinct accent and cadence. It's very much, it's kind of like Eckhart Tolle. Like once you tune in and you get it, you're like, okay, now I can roll with this dude.
Yeah, your job is to tell me when I speak too fast. I always speak too fast.
Yes.
I teach my classes, I tell my students to raise their hands. And so your job is to tell me this is way too fast for radio. And I'm going to slow down.
Hey, man, with technology today, people can just hit a slow motion button and then. So before we get too far gone in ridiculousness, give us a 60-second version of who Moran Surf is.
So I guess in the context of this sitting, I'm a professor of neuroscience and business. And I use the knowledge I acquired in the last decade in how the brain works to try to help businesses and range of people who are interested in how decisions are being made make better choices.
How does the brain work?
No, that's press power.
Yeah, just like a little switch. If y'all get like switches implanted in our heads, that would be actually really cool. In the past 10 years, what have been some things you've uncovered as far as like, I guess, especially when it comes to business, it's always the power of persuasion, right? We're always, businesses are trying to get customers to do X, take some sort of action. Are there any sort of like key pillars that you've identified as like, all right, here's where persuasion and neuroscience collide in business?
So we look at different range of things, but we look at things like how people decide and not just how a decision is being made in the brain, but also how far before you made a choice can we know your choice? As in, can I go an hour before, seconds before, minutes before, when you're born, and know what you're going to do when you're at the aisle and there's Colgate on the left and Crest on the right? How is it going to happen? So that's one domain that we're looking into. We're looking at, in the context of marketing, we call it consumer neuroscience or neuromarketing. We try to understand how messages affect your brain, and it has different applications. How does the price affect your brain? Why is $1.99 different than two brain-wise? Like, why is the brain reading it differently?
Yes.
We look at the effects of temperature, the height of your chair, the color of the wall, and everything about your brain, and so how accordingly messages get delivered differently. We look at, so this is all in the context of marketing. In the context of finance, we look at risk. So you're about to make a choice to buy something. How does your brain process risk?
Right.
That's another domain. In the context of, I guess, decision making as a whole, we try to see if there's things that make you decide better. So for every person, there's a profile of their brain. And now we can see that you, Chris, make better choices in the morning and I make better ones in the evening. And some person makes better choices when they're hungry and one when they're full and one when they're talking to other people and one where they're just by themselves. So we kind of try to understand the effects of those things on your specific brain and find ways to make your choices better.
Now, that sound, the fact that you use the word specific, right, it means that, you know, how individualized is this or are these types of services? Because like you said, the lighting, the temperature, and like we all respond to it different neurologically, physiologically. But then you go like, are there profiles that you can start to identify of like almost like a horoscope of neurology?
So it seems that, so there's a saying that my grandfather used always when we were kids, and he said, you're very unique, just like everyone else. And in that sense, I think that we start to see that there's a lot of similarities between brains. They cluster. So there's this type of brain and that type of brain. And we can kind of quickly figure out which cluster do you fall into and help you make better choices. But in a way, there are things that affect everyone in a similar way.
Right.
There's things that would be different for you. So you might be a person who everyone does different things when they're tired.
Yeah.
So we know that. But now there's differences in how you respond to being tired. So some people are able to at least identify that they're not making good choices and do different.
Well, what's an example? Like, I mean, as you know, if I were tired, which I am very tired right now, if I'm tired versus I'm like awake and alert, because I know in sometimes in the creative realm, they talk about like the delirium of being tired is actually feeds the creative process. But, you know, at the same time, like being alert and fresh is also, you know, a good thing. Is there a balance between those two?
So you kind of said it right perfectly. You said that basically that for every task, there's a different brain state that's better. So I'll give an example. There's a study that was done by colleagues of mine where they took judges. And those are judges that have to make a simple choice per all judges. So they just have to get a case and read the case and they don't even see anyone in front of them. They have to make a decision whether the guy gets parole or not.
Right.
So they see...
Was this a black person or no?
I think that's
why they try to... if he was black, we'd be like, yes, no parole.
So they get cases like that all day right. long, and I think they don't even see the person, so I don't think that other than
I'm
the name,
joking, yeah.
they can't even know.
Yeah, because the name will give it away to you, but in some cases.
And I think, I'm trying to think if they looked at things like gender and race and anything, but I think that they try to do it as clean as possible.
Right, just regardless. The facts.
So what happens is that if you look at the kind of the function of how many people get parole over the day, it's better to be the person who gets seen at 8 a.m. when they start a day than to be the one at 9 a.m., then 11 a.m. Basically, what they see is that in the morning, 8 a.m., people get a lot more kind of paroles. And as it gets closer to noon, your chances are below 20% to get parole. And then the judge goes, takes a break and has lunch. And then at 1:30, they come back. And again, your best time to kind of be seen by the judge is 1:30 or 8 a.m. because the kind of the graph again goes from 8:30 most likely, less likely at 2, less likely at 2:30, and so on.
So what happens? Well, like why is that arc? Why is that there's this decline? Is it like fatigue? Is it like the input? Like, well, I don't know. What's the...
So the suggestion there is, so first of all, they just show the fact, but now they try to suggest that maybe it has to do with fatigue. It has to do with being tired, with hungry, with the brain of the person changes, and they actually focus on different things in the same case. They just see them. I think what they do right now, by the way, is they have every case be seen by two judges and they randomize the order, because it used to be the case that you get seen at 8 a.m. and your name is also starting with A. So, you know, it was alphabetically and you just had more people.
Right.
So now they kind of try to randomize all of those things. But in a way, we know that, and we know that the brain actually has a mechanism in the front of the brain that's supposed to regulate thoughts that are coming from within, let's simplify it, and they're kind of more regulated by how hungry you are, how the temperature in the room changes, and we know that your brain is supposed to be good in controlling them, but we're not as good. So over the day, we get tired, brain-wise.
Is there something that you can do, like, let's stick with the judge's example, right? As opposed to changing the, you know, randomizing and not being, like, alphabetical order, is there something you can go and talk to the judges or the people who are doing the tasks and say, hey, just, like, and just make them alert that by 11 o'clock, you're going to be a jerk, right?
So they try, and that's actually you hit right away the point that neuroscience adds to business where there's a difficulty, because people won't tell you that they have these biases. If you ask a person, why did you choose this thing or why are you making this choice, everyone's going to claim that they're making the choice totally rationally and like very clean way, and we know they're not. So it's very hard to convince a person that their choice wasn't made in a way that they understand.
Right.
And we have a lot of evidence now that we can, you know, try to convince people, and it's true for all of us. So even I, who spent my entire kind of decade trying to understand that, am falling for all those biases, because it's just too hard to control for all of the little parameters, from the temperature in the room to what things ended up being held in my hand when I made the choice. I'll give you an example. Just to kind of give you an idea of how difficult life is.
Thank you. This is exactly what I need today.
I'll tell you why there's hope. So I'll start by breaking everything and then making you feel like why there's hope. So here's an example of there's a study. So I'm talking science first, but then we're going to...
Sure, no, go for it.
Take it into the business world. So here's the science version of that. So they bring you to the lab and they say, come, here's a cup of tea that they give you, and they have you sit down and they ask you to write... like for 10 minutes, write something about your relationship with your mom. What do you think about your mother? Turns out that what you write about your mom is mostly governed by the temperature of the tea that they gave you when you entered the room. So if they give people hot tea, they write warmer and nicer things about their mom rather than if they give them a cup of iced tea. Now, no one would ever tell you, you know, I wrote like nasty things about my mom, unless they're Jewish, because of like the temperature of the tea that you gave me. But people end up like, so they break into two groups and they see that it affects the choice. Like people actually write different things. The weight of the paper they give them, if it's like a thick paper or thin one, affects the heaviness of their thoughts. The temperature in the room, the height of the chair, what words someone uses when they the task, how many steps they're asked. All of those things affect us, very minute effects, but no one believes that their choices are governed by that. Everyone would say, I made a choice totally by myself. You think that you're kind of in control. And the reality is that a lot of things happen to your brain. And the more we know them, we can at least, you know, be aware of the problem and maybe then try to either fix it or at least exploit it or something like that.
This actually, it makes me think about the movie Minority Report. Right. And like the science of, I know you're going to commit a crime, you know, 2 weeks from now. and maybe the visualization of it may be a little bit false. But the idea of the stuff that you're talking about, I mean, can it go that far and that exact? Or can a person or group of persons be manipulated in such like micro increments that next thing you know, they're murderous or, you know, or they buy the hamburger that you've been wanting them to buy?
So the field of neuroscience.
Two very different examples, by the way, murder and hamburgers. But
it's funny, I used two examples of pornography and organic food to demonstrate. So I'll tell you how I use
that. All right, we're on the same page. Good. All right.
So I think that the field of neuroscience in law is an interesting one that gets a lot of attention right now because we understand more and more that some elements of your choices aren't under your control, and also that maybe they govern something about the choice you made in a way that you couldn't change. So right now there's a movement that a lot of scientists are trying to go to basically say, let's scan the brain of people who are convicted in crime and see in a way if the punishment should be about just putting them in prison because they behave badly or maybe sending them to a different place that can help them. I'll give you, if you want, examples of that. So there's the classical story that I really like to ponder on of this guy called Charles Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
He became famous in grave circumstances in the 60s when he took a cab from his apartment in Austin, Texas, road to the University of Austin, climbed the tallest building there, and started spraying people from the tower and killing a number of people and then waiting for the emergency people to show up and kill them. And he was doing bad things for about an hour until the police killed him. And when they tried to investigate what led him to behave like that, they looked at his background and he had no sign of anything bad about him. Like, he was a great guy. He was discharged from the Marines the year before. Everything was okay about this guy until they went to his apartment and they found his diary. And in his diary, he writes that he feels his brain is not the same. He's changing. He, I think, goes to a psychiatrist before to see if he's okay and gets sent home. And he reports, he said, I'm not okay, but he doesn't get help. And even the night before this killing, he writes in his diary, I think I'm going to do something bad tomorrow. I don't know what it is, but I'm worried. And I'm asking that if I end up dead, someone's going to conduct an autopsy on my brain and see what's wrong with it. And even if the check for $30,000 for this autopsy. So when they do the autopsy, they see that there's a massive tumor pressing on a part of the brain called the amygdala that has to do with fear and aggression and may have led to this behavior. And now the question is, what do you do if you're a person like that? So now we say that legally, we say that if you know there's a problem, you should do something. Like, he had a choice, and therefore, like, he is doing something bad. But at the same time, the question is, like, who is in control there? And now I went too far from like the world of innovation and business. But in business, we can now say, okay, let's see which part of you controls your choices, and activate that part when we need to. We know that you make different choices when you're under pressure. So all of the marketing for impulse buying, like, you know, the chewing gum that you buy or the People magazine that you buy when you're about to exit the cashier. Now we know kind of how your brain operates in those moments, and maybe we can change the color of the cover of the magazine to make it more appealing to a brain state like that.
That's interesting, because it's funny. The whole time you're talking about this stuff, I have an unopened cold water and a cup with Mountain Dew in it.
Let's talk about how did you choose? Okay, so you
I don't know how. It was just like, for me, I'm trying to understand why I chose the Mountain Dew when intrinsically I know it's not the best choice for me, right? I just came from the dentist. You're like, oh, we got some work to do on you, but at the same time, like, I'm going to have Mountain Dew. You know, I don't know if it's like some sort of like, oh, I deserve like a little bit of a reward or a treat or something, or am I just like naturally inclined toward the garbage?
So here's the pornography and the organic food.
Yes. Where they come. Yeah, all right. Let's start with pornography.
So we start with pornography. So we know that people, sometimes when you ask them questions, they're not going to tell you the right answer for two reasons. Either because they don't know, or because they don't want to tell you. So this is where the two examples come. So I think it was Los Angeles when there was a supermarket who was about to open a little branch in a specific neighborhood where there were already a lot of supermarkets there. And they said, we're going to survey everyone in this zip code and ask them, will they buy an even healthier food in this supermarket that's a little more expensive? And in the survey, there's like 100% of the people saying, of course, we're going to buy the healthiest food because it's Los Angeles. And, you know, whoever lives in the 90036 says they're going to buy the best food out there.
That's exactly where I live, by the way. Really? I don't know. That's kind of scary that you even said that. Why did you make that choice? No, just kidding. Go ahead.
Total guess.
It's like totally weird. That is actually exactly where I live.
So maybe you were in the survey.
Yeah. Did you do, was this your survey? You're like, nope. You noticed my handwriting? All right, go ahead. All right.
So they had the survey. They opened the supermarket. Everyone said they're going to buy. And the supermarket closes after 1 year because no one buys. Because at the end of the day, when you go to buy a milk and you say, this one is even better, but it's like $10 more and I need just milk for cornflakes, it's going to be $2, I don't care. You end up buying the one you want. And that's when people lie not to us. They lie to themselves. So many people we know buy clothes for the skinnier version of themselves. There's a spike in people buying gym memberships towards Christmas or just before the beginning of the year. Birthdays are a good time to sell things that you would commit to for 1 year but not going to use. So all of those things suggest that people really are lying to themselves. So if we ask them, we're going to get the answer of the side of the brain that doesn't know really who you are. And it lives in your brain. I mean, we don't have to go that far. We can think about ourselves going to sleep pretty much every night and setting the alarm to 6 a.m., and then when you wake up in the morning, you're a different person. Suddenly, it doesn't look like you should be up at 6 a.m. And suddenly, and things aren't as plausible as they used to be like last night. And you have a button called snooze that's just made for this other part of you to stay a little bit in bed longer.
Right.
So this is all a side of our brain that we can tap into right now. We can actually look inside. And I'll tell you if you want in a second how we do that. But see how reliable you are when you make a choice about the future. And we see that you're not that reliable. And we can see why you're not. And that's the health food, organic food kind of example that suggests that people are lying to themselves, not to us. So if you ask them in a focus group, they're going to actually tell you something that if you try to use what they say, you're going to be mistaken because they lied not just to you, but also to themselves.
Right.
Pornography is an example where I actually was running a study where we tried to see something about people's choices when it comes to pornography. And we had a survey about 1,000 people and we asked them questions about their viewing patterns. And out of 100 people, only one person even watches pornography according to the survey. So 99 people said that they never watch pornography. Now, if you look at the bandwidth of the internet, it's like 80% of the internet is pornography. So
there's
just one guy who runs around and watches all the pornography in the world for everyone. Or people probably just didn't tell us the truth because they were embarrassed or they didn't want to disclose things in the survey. So whatever it is, people aren't likely to tell you the truth if they feel that it's somehow judged.
It's also, I mean, I think, yes, the judging part of it is, but I think we intrinsically want to be better people, and the things that we perceive as bad, we genuinely want to move away from. So like I do, like the water is here because I want to drink the water, right? But you know, at some point, like you give in to, for the sake of conversation, I'll say the lower self in that instance, or you know, like I do want to eat healthy. Sure, I will buy the $3 bread versus the dollar bread, and then when it comes down to it, like I think the other self is not so much lying, but maybe more so like an aspirational version of yourself.
I agree. So lying, calling it lying is a bit like extreme. And we know that people, when given the choice and when they are explained everything and when they're calmer and everything is easier, they actually usually are better for themselves than they are under pressure. So now knowing that is useful. So we actually, if we want to exploit them, we might want to induce pressure to make them do bad things. If we want to help them, we want to create situations where they have a little more of their brain to control the choice and make a better decision. And this term is called cognitive load. And we actually know now.
Cognitive load?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we know now more and more about how
it has nothing to do with the porn part of it.
No.
Okay.
Right. but it has to do a lot with like choices, and I'll give you two examples, one about poverty and one about dieting. And tell me when you want to stop talking about like science.
Don't worry. I will. Well, this is great. I'm having a blast.
So here's the dieting part, and here's the poverty part. So dieting, there's a study by a guy at Stanford, and he, I'm probably going to butcher a little bit of the details, but the kind of essence is that he brings people to the lab and he says, you're going to get advice from a nutritionist on how to eat healthy. And most of the people that he invited, people who claim that they want a diet or they have a reason to see the nutritionist. So they come to the lab and then they get sent to a room, and in this room, they're given a number that would be their ID, and they have to go back to the lobby, and then someone's going to call them in 10 minutes. They have to give them the number, and then they're going to get this advice. So that's the experiment.
Right.
The experiment itself actually is broken in the following way. Half the people get a very simple number to remember, like 1, 2, 3. And half the people get a 10-digit long, confusing number, 1, 2, 7, 4, 2, 2, 6, 6, 1, 5, 0. And both of them have to sit in the lobby and just wait to be called for 10 minutes. Now, the experiment starts now, because in the lobby, there's a delicious, tasty cake. And what they measured is how many people took nibbles of the cake while they were waiting for 10 minutes. What they saw is that the people that had only short digits to remember, short number, didn't take it all from the cake. And mm-hmm. The people who had a lot of numbers to remember took a lot of like bites. And it's because their brain was occupied with trying to remember these long digits. They didn't have enough cognitive load. They didn't have enough mental capacity to also suppress the desire to eat the cake. So both people want to eat the cake, but one of them has enough brain to not eat the cake. The other one just doesn't have it because he's focusing on remembering the number, and then he's eating more of the cake. And then they all came to get advice on dieting, but they fail already in the lobby while waiting. So this was just one evidence of the fact that loading your brain with things actually changes your behavior. And now if you talk about poverty, that's a topic that a friend of mine really cares about a lot, and he's a professor at Princeton who spends a lot of time looking at that, because he says that poverty is a sense of cognitive load. So if you're poor, you're all the time worried about things, and you constantly make commitments like about the future, and you make decisions. And you know, if you go to a cab right now, you probably don't know what the meter starts on. You can have noted it's about $2, $3, but you have no idea. But a
you don't know how the rate changes so fast. You're like, well, hey, wait, just stop. I'll get out here. This is fine.
So you kind of live in a world, and when you go walk around in Los Angeles and you go to a supermarket to buy food, you kind of know that things should be around $4 to $5 each, and you buy for a family for a week, you spend maybe $200, but you don't really know how much each item costs. But if you're poor, you know exactly how much each item costs. You know exactly what the meter starts on every cab. You make a decision all the time whether you're going to walk home with your bags or you're going to take a cab. So all of those choices are little choices, but they actually overload your brain such that at the end of the day, you're making bad choices financially that affect your life. And it's not that you're that you're not smart. You're actually very smart. It's just that any person who would be under that pressure would make the same mistake.
That kind of goes into like, you know, a little bit more on the sociological side, where people like we kind of fetishize being busy, right? Oh, I'm so busy. Oh, I'm so busy. And then, you know, I would imagine, kind of based on what you just said, that the fact that I am so busy is because I'm making, everybody wants an easier life, right? So, but because I'm busy, I'm not focused on how to make things easier. Like, what should I be eliminating? What should I be focused more on? What, you know, that, because I ask everybody on the show about their filtering process, because everybody's a multi-hyphenate. They have multiple projects, things that are going on, you know, career shifts, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, but I think from what you just said, it's like the busy syndrome can even be cognitive overload. Oh, look at me. I'm sounding all like I should teach your class.
Definitely.
No, but am I right in that? Is that, you know, is that something that you could look at and say?
Definitely. So being busy is a state, and it's also an act of amount of chores. So for the same day, some person might be overloaded by the things they have to do, and they're going to start failing a lot of those things, and some person would not. And I think that some of it is just the brain. So for the same set of activities, some person is kind of troubled by them, and it makes it hard. Some people are not, and we can now know that. So we can actually know, and we have a lot of studies right now that are done by us, where we basically take people and push them to the limit when it comes to being busy, when it comes to having activities that are physical. We just push them to the limit, and we intentionally make them break.
Right.
Like whatever break is for you. And so it could be that you're starting to.
I want to make sure my wife listens to this podcast.
So whatever it is that your wife thinks is.
Damn it, woman!
Going to break you. We try to get you there.
Right.
And we try to look at your brain just before you break, like the second before, and see in a way if we could have predicted what would make you break and how you are handling those states. So I give an example of like easy case, and then we can talk about like being busy. So we take athletes that are extreme athletes, so they're very used to like being pushed to the limits. And we bring them to the lab and we say, we're going to put you on the stationary bike, let's say, and we're going to ask you to cycle for a while. And we're going to make it harder and harder over time. We just ask you one thing, please don't ever stop.
Right. Says,
sorry, what? I said, just don't stop until I tell you to. Forever, as long as I'm not telling you, you've got to continue. And the guy says, sure, okay. And they start cycling and we make it harder and harder and harder. And at some point they're sweating and they're saying, when am I going to stop? It's too hard. And we say, just continue until I tell you to. And actually, we're not planning to stop them ever. And we want them to break. So at some point, they're going to say, enough. I can't do it anymore.
Right.
It's too much. And then we say, fantastic, get off the bike. Let's look at your brain. And we see how their brain looks just in the minute leading to them breaking. And that's a moment where your part of the brain that is in pain says, I'm in pain. And there's another part that says, continue.
Right.
And at some point, the pain wins. And tomorrow, we can bring you over again and say, let's do the same thing we did yesterday. But this time, when you get to the moment where you're about to break, we're going to give you acoustic feedback telling you that we know that you're in this state. And now let's try to train your brain to overcome this moment and maybe stay longer or recognize this moment. And now you can think of a CEO of a company, an athlete, you and your wife, anyone can right. basically say, I want everyone to know when I'm at this state, or I want to know myself at this state, and then act accordingly. And then I know that maybe this is a moment I should make decisions. This is a moment I shouldn't buy stocks in Enron. This is a moment that I shouldn't buy this
Mountain Dew.
This is a moment that's a moment you want to know about yourself.
Shout out to Mountain Dew, by the way. It's a great product if you guys want to sponsor the show.
And it worked on you.
They got me, yeah. Right? I think it sounds like also over time, or if you're aware of your breaking points, you can also increase capacity.
Right.
Right. So especially in the case of an athlete or a busy person, I use the quotation marks, but you learn what that limit is. And then that's kind of like, but that could be anything, physical, mental, emotional, like being able to expand your capacity.
We more and more, we know more things about how those things link to your brain and what affects your capacity, if you want, your load. And for each person, it seems to be a little bit different. So some people are just born better. So there's some people just born, you know, there's this famous marshmallow test. You know, you probably know the movie.
Somebody else just told me the marshmallow test like a few days ago.
It was like it's a classical, it's fun to see.
Oh, right, the kid, but go ahead and tell the audience because I will tear it up. I will mess it all up.
But I would do the same probably. Because I only know the movie, I've never seen the actual paper. So I know that the what you know from like reading, Wikipedia.
Right.
But the story is that they bring kids, it was in the 80s, they bring kids and they tell them, kids age 4, tell them, here's a piece of marshmallow. You can eat it now and leave, or you can wait a few minutes until I come back. And if you waited and you didn't eat that, I'm going to give you 2 marshmallows. And then they just see how they work with that particular state of desire and what strategies they use to not eat the marshmallow. And, you know, in the end, they either get the second one or not.
Right.
But this was done in the 80s, and now those kids are in their 40s. So now we can actually try to link the kids who were really good in controlling themselves as 4-year-olds to where they are in the world right now. And we seem to see that, and that's where I'm kind of going to butcher the result because I know the Wikipedia, but we know that they are better decision makers. They're healthier. They make for better partners, like husbands or wives. They make for good investors.
They make really good s'mores.
Yeah.
Which ones do or don't. So speaking of choices, right, you mentioned earlier this has been 10 years of your life so far. And prior to that was a very different life.
Yeah.
So talk about a little bit what you were doing before and why you made the choice to switch to what you're doing now.
So I always struggle in finding ways to say it in a way that doesn't upset the audience. I used to be a hacker. Which is to say that I think the term that is now used is a penetration testing. Sounds kinky, but it means
back to the pornography.
The point is that you were hired by banks or by the FBI or by big organizations that try to be secure, and they ask you and your team. This was us in the late 90s and early 2000s. We get asked by, say, the bank to try to break into the bank and find flaws in their security and then teach them how we could get in so they can secure themselves better and stop the bad guys from coming in. So this was my job for nearly a decade. I was trained, so I kind of grew up with computers.
Right.
And learned how to play with them, you know, how to increase the life.
And you grew up in Israel, correct?
Yeah. I was born in France and raised in Israel. And I think that roughly when I was 6 years old, computer became affordable to a person in a household.
Right.
And most people use them to, you know, put recipes and write some text in word processors. And I had a few computer games that were copyrighted, so I tried to kind of see if we can find a way to copy them without kind of overcoming the copyright. And there was the early days of internet, which was a BBS, bulletin board services, where I could communicate with other hackers across the world and learn some techniques to break codes.
What drew you to that world, right? Like, you know, I find most hackers start super young. I mean, I could be like, nobody's like 40 and like, oh, you know what I'm going to do tomorrow? I'm going to be a hacker. Like most, and we've had a few on the show and they've all started at like 13, 11, you know, or younger, or, you know, somewhere around that age. What was it that drew you to computers in that way?
So I think we benefit from the fact that computers were kind of grew up with us. So PC XT came to life when I came to life, kind of. So it was easier. So if someone tries to get into the world of hacking right now, there's a lot they have to know about how hard drives work and how the internet works, and just to catch up to. And so when we grew up, right, there's only one way to turn a computer on, and there's only one computer system, that operating system that you can work with. So it was kind of easier to, as they got more complex, we knew all the steps. So it was that. But I think for me, computer games. I got Mario 1, or what's called, I think, Montezuma's Revenge, in the 80s, and I kept failing. And I said, I bet there's a way to increase my score or get one more life to do that. And then you learn that it's not too hard to play with the insides, the guts of the program, and get better. And then you see that it actually is the same technique that can be used to increase your life in different game. King's Quest was the game I played when I was a kid.
Well, like, I mean, like, you know, I probably didn't game as hard as you did, right? And like, I played my Atari, and then as PlayStation came, or Sega, like, I would look for cheat codes for certain things. But I never, like, for me, it didn't gravitate toward a career in hacking and breaking into banks, right? So, you know, was there sort of a psychological draw for you? Like, we had, what's the guy's name?
Matt.
No, there was another guy on the show. Not, yeah, I'm botching his name, but he is a genius. The show Scorpion is based on his life.
Okay.
Walter O'Brien. And he felt like, I mean, a little bit more depth, but it was like, oh, computers talk or think like I think, you know. Was there something that, you know, that kept, like swimming was my thing, right? So I loved swimming. But the fact that you had this deep passion that it became a career for a great period of your life.
I'm trying to think. So I think I always liked puzzles. And I share what you just said about the fact that they think in a way, in a very serial kind of way about puzzles. And I'm trying to think, this is like a good question. This is like there's a saying among scientists, it's not research, it's me search.
Right.
I feel like I have to give you a good answer to why I...
We can come back to it. I was curious, especially given the fact that, you know, 10 years ago, you kind of switched gears. I mean, I think instead of tinkering with, you know, electronic machines, it's a biological machine, right? But so you were doing the hacking for banks and things, and then we want to get into like a little bit of the choice you made to transition.
So ultimately, so I was a kid who cared about that, but I think where it actually became a serious thing that that became a profession was I was in Israel, so I was recruited to the Israeli army, and I was in intelligence. In intelligence, you just are surrounded by people that all share this knowledge on how computers work and how to hack them. And suddenly there's also a cause. Someone tells you, you've got to do that for this reason. And suddenly your job is to try to hack computers for the country. And there's like... more, you know, there's more funding for things. Suddenly it becomes a bigger picture thing. So I did that for over 3 years as a soldier. And I think this is not only where I learned a lot of other skills that I didn't have as a kid, I also found a lot of people that were kind of like me. And it's common for me in Israel that you finish the army and you basically get a profession in the army. It's kind of like it's formative years, age 18 to 21. It's when people in the US go to college. So you kind of... all of your life happens in those 3 or 4 years in the army. So when you finish the army, usually you have a profession. and you can go to college if you want to get another first degree, but you can also go and start working in your profession. And a lot of my friends just finished the army and went and started companies in the domain of security.
Got it.
So I was one of, so I feel this was also important. And also it turns out that it was a good financial choice because now we're talking 1998 and 1999, the internet starts getting into houses and I start seeing banks and I tell right away that there was a problem with their security. So it was much easier.
Right.
To, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of like the simple example we can give you of like how hacking was, but the example that comes to mind is Amazon circa 2000. They have a website that allows you to buy products, but every product you select and you buy gets saved in a cookie on your computer. So basically you have a little file that says you just bought a CD for $5, and another another line in the same product, it says you bought a book for $10, but this is saved on your end. So you can just go into this file and change the numbers from $5 to negative $5.
Right.
And then when you go to the checkout page, it just tallies all the numbers you came up with, and suddenly the negative $5 kind of balances the plus $5, and you
right.
get to buy 10 items for $0, and you actually give your credit card and you swipe it online, so to speak, and you pay $0 and you get all those items because no one checked the client side version of hacking. So this is like very simple. So everyone could have done it 15 years ago. It wasn't hard.
Damn it.
You just have to know this.
Missed that.
You can actually
whole...
you know, change to negative $20 and have Amazon pay you
right.
when you buy. So this is called they now have a name for that. It's called cookie tampering. That's a name for the attack. It's trivial. Any hacker knows that, but go back 15 years ago, no bank knew about it, no security company knew about it, so here's a way to do that. And this is equivalent to, I think, go back 40 years, Steve Jobs and Wozniak, they learned the same thing about how to hack into phones, and they used that. So I think that there's something to hackers that aligns well with the innovation
right.
and allows and kind of works well with breaking rules. And I think that
we were talking about this yesterday, but like, you know, the whole Matt Mason idea of his book and mm-hmm. like the pirate's dilemma is that they are breaking a lot of rules that actually become things that are, you know, better for us in the long run. It's that transitional period where it's not cool and people are like, oh, like I remember when camera phones started like becoming a little bit more publicly used, and I would get real, like I would get kind of pissed off if you're like at a bar or you're somewhere and people are taking pictures and they're not being mindful of the fact that, you know, I'm standing there and they're taking a picture of their friend. And then now suddenly you see people taking pictures, like you keep ordering your drink, or you used to kind of shy away from like, let them take their picture and then I'll continue what I'm doing. So there's these transitional phases that happen in between time where there's discomfort, right?
I think I saw that in the Google Maps has this feature where you can, on top of like asking how to get from A to B, you can ask, say, how to get from A to B and only make right turns. So if you want to, you know, like make right turns in lights that are red or something
right.
like that. So you can ask for a map that also has another kind of level to it. So you can also ask to get from A to B and not be seen by cameras. So you can say, give me a way to drive from A to B without being seen by camera. And I tried it a few weeks ago in New York. And if you try to get from Greenwich Village in New York to the Upper East Side, the answer is go to the Hudson River, swim up to... there's just no way to go between those two sections without being seen by cameras. There's just too many cameras in little phone booth and streetlights. And you just cannot... So this is a world where you accept now that we're just being filmed. Every time it's a crime, a week after you can see a kind of a street camera that shows exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So in a way, this is the kind of world we accept.
There's a lot of dialogue with that in London right now, right? About like too many cameras, and even to the point where it's like it's such a cost to the city that they're like reconsidering to just the amount of resources it takes to operate them and monitor them versus the ROI of catching criminals or, you know, whatever they're doing. But there was that one funny viral video, the one guy that was super drunk and they just followed him like all the way. It was so funny. So at some point you go brains.
So it's going to be hard for me to explain. I've been asked often what was the moment that made me decide to change, but I think that it's a combination of a moment of kind of enlightenment,
right.
a meeting with a very impressive person, being fed up with doing what I did, and also a failure at work. So I guess somewhere between those two, but I guess the two highlight moments is one I think we got bored of doing the same thing. So we tried to kind of expand the business of trying to break into banks, not just virtually, to also trying to actively go to banks and try to break in.
Right.
And we were not good at that. So there were a number of failures of us trying to physically go and rob a bank and being stopped in various states of the way that said, I guess this suggests that I'm just bored of what I'm doing and maybe I should think of career change. This is one reason.
So you had your own sort of fatigue around it, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of couple like, all right, like I get, you know, like we're just going to go break into another one and it may or may not work and I kind of don't care.
Exactly. And yeah. I think that... So it got to the point where I think we, at the time, we had pretty much every bank that is big was our client. And we, every 6 months, broke into their systems, wrote a report on what they should do, and then they used the report to say, now that we know that, but you found this flaw, we're going to fix this flaw, but there's not going to be any problem. And we used to come back again 6 months later and do the same process and find a different flaw. So it was almost seeing the same clients also.
Right.
So it was, and trying the same thing. So there was, I think, a boredom. But I also, I think... cared a little bit about the brain, as it was a fascinating question to me forever before I knew what ways I can actually tackle that. And I guess I had a meeting with Francis Crick. He was in San Diego, and I happened to meet him. And he's one of the two people who explained the double helix and won the Nobel Prize in the 50s for, you know, explaining how DNA works.
Right.
Watson and Crick. And according to him, once you get the Nobel Prize for something serious, you get to ask questions about things that are impossible to ask. So you can first like get Nobel Prize in physics and then study aliens. So he got Nobel Prize in biology explaining how the double helix work. And then he spent the next 40 years trying to understand how consciousness works. And you're only allowed to do that after you win the Nobel Prize in something real. So when I met him, I talked to him a little bit about my career. It was very random, but interesting. And he said something like, you know, he didn't know that there's actually a career called hacker. This was like something that he was surprised. But he himself was a hacker, so to speak, during World War II. So, you know, he was similar to Alan Turing and all of those guys who basically were hackers. And then when the war is over, they translate their knowledge to explaining how computers should work and solving puzzles in physics and explaining how DNA works. So they all channeled their knowledge in statistics and computer algorithms to something that changed the world. He said, okay, if you know how to hack computers, you should forget about this stupid business of yours and go do something meaningful in your life, which is look at the brain, which to him was a similar
thing.
It's a black box that you can feed input in and see what comes out and understand what goes on inside. So this is what he said. By the way, there's absolutely no similarity between my career and his career, but he saw enough similarity to suggest that I should do that and it was enough to support me and write a letter of recommendation that says, take this guy and make him a neuroscientist. And when Francis Crick writes a letter of recommendation, you get in.
That's a pretty good letter.
Yeah.
No, it's cool. What has been the thing that's fascinated you the most about human behavior?
So I think that I think humans are fascinating, and I think to me the most interesting thing is that we're understanding more and more now the gap between what you call, or the gap between your free will and the actual will. So we think that we decide now, we think that we're in control, and it seems that it's not the case, and it seems that either we decide seconds before we think we decided, or we might not be in control entirely. And to me, this is not just an interesting scientific question, but also a philosophical debate. Like, who is in control? There's this quote that I really like by Isaac Asimov, this science fiction book author, and he says, the bishop is the most important piece on the chessboard in the eyes of the bishop. And in a way, to me, it suggests that we think the king is the most important one and then the queen, and we're probably the bishop in this chessboard that's called our brain, but we still think that this is the most important piece, and we live life kind of thinking that this is what we should be.
Right.
But we know more and more that the choice of water versus Mountain Dew that you made 20 minutes ago wasn't entirely yours, and you're going to come up with an answer why you made this choice, but we know that you're not reliable. Your memory is not reliable. Your explanation of yourself is not reliable. And then the question is, who's in control?
I think the Mountain Dew actually was Sean's fault. He asked me to go get him a sandwich on the way here, and I was like, oh, well, can I get a Mountain Dew to go with the sandwich?
That's the answer. Sean is in control. For
Sean is in control. That's the title of this episode. And then people are like, what? So, but that's interesting. Then if where does the control come? Like, are we just like an accumulation of experiences, and those kind of like determine what I'm going to do? You know, 45 minutes from now.
So we don't know. That's the bottom line. We know some things. We know that it's not happening right now, but it happened in the past. As in, sometime before you started speaking, the brain kind of created the grammar and the syntax and the language and chose the topic and already started creating the pattern of activity that you're going to be what you said. But you, if you asked, will say that it happened when you spoke.
Right.
In many ways, you and I, when we speak right now, we're also listening to ourselves for the first time. You don't really think about the next word and then say it. It's kind of happening, and in a way, you're also an observer of reality. Like, you say something, and then you say, oh, I guess I believe what I said because it came out of my mouth. But
right.
You know, it's not really true. Like, somewhere there is this you who decides, and it's the you who chooses to drink the Mountain Dew, and it's the person who buys Crest or Colgate, and it's the person who invests in stock, and it's the person who falls in love, and all of those people happen to you, and you assume that it's you.
Right.
It's like an interesting moment to understand that. And it's also an interesting moment philosophically to accept that we're just another piece in a big chessboard and not the main one.
Wow. That's.
I have a colleague. Since I'm somehow coming up inspiring, I should say like one inspiring thing that I...
No, it's not uninspiring. But it kind of opens up a Pandora's box of... you know, other possibilities and other ways of thinking, because, you know, the idea of spontaneity almost goes away, right? Like, are we spontaneous? Or like, let's go to the beach. You're like, no, like you, if according to what you just said, it's kind of like, not, it wasn't as spontaneous as you might have imagined.
So here's the beauty of it. Now I'll try to flip that into why I feel it's beautiful and why the world is so exciting now. To people in the business world who care about neuroscience and for neuroscientists who try to understand how the brain works. Go back 400 years ago, Galileo Galilei points his telescope to the moons of Jupiter and he expects the moons to orbit in a specific direction and it doesn't work. And he's baffled by that and he tries to align the equations. And finally, the only solution he can come up with is that the Earth isn't the center of the universe, but the sun is. And this troubles him because he's religious and it's also a change of everything. But after a while, he just goes with the equations and puts the sun in the center and goes into a world where we're just one more planet out of many orbiting a sun that's out of many. And it kind of changes everything.
Right.
First, he was very troubled. But once he accepted that, it actually allowed us to now explore the wide reaches of the universe. And suddenly we saw that there's a much bigger thing out there than we imagined because we were dethroned from the center, but found out that there's a lot more to see. In the same way, I think that right now, neuroscientists are dethroning us from being the king in this chessboard, but rather being the bishop,
right?
Which we're very much against. We're not happy with because it's kind of taking who's spontaneous person, who's making a choice, and what's behind that. But once we accept that, I think we're going to explore the most interesting thing in the universe, which is us. We're going
right.
to see that there's more planets in our head. And now we become a really interesting character.
No, it's great because I went to the Buckminster Fuller Institute earlier this year,
mm-hmm.
and there's this great like dome presentation, and it's like an animation of the universe, and it's a voiceover while you're watching it, and somebody's like explaining it to you live what you're looking at, and then at the end of it, or not the end of, but the realization comes that you are like the center of the universe is everywhere. So at any given time, you are the center of the universe or your universe, and so like I'm just getting a little quantum, but like the idea that like we are and are not in control like at any given moment. So
and it doesn't it matters philosophically, but it doesn't really change. Like, you're not going to live life in any way differently knowing that maybe in your brain there's biases. You kind of live life the same way. It's important to ponder on that every now and then, and I think this is what the show is about. It's like a chance for every person to say, what does it mean for my life, and
right.
what can I do? But in many ways, life goes on, and it's the beauty of life that we don't need to know all of those things. Like, we don't really need to know how we play tennis and what happens, all the mechanics to play tennis. We just play tennis and we walk down the stairs without thinking of every step and of the way. And that's the beauty of our brain. It is a huge machine to take
yeah.
a lot of patterns and create meaning out of them. And that's, I think, what is beautiful about us.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny because like you and I both do some work with brands, right? Like and help them figure out the psychology of the consumer and, you know, what, how we can persuade them. What colors do we want? Like, how do we want to light the grocery store? All these different choices we make. And like, I always wonder where the balance is between overthinking it and underthinking it, because it's, you know, you can oversimplify something and go like, oh, those people like this, let's do that. And then the other, the overcomplication of things, and I find this on both sides of the equation with clients I work with, it's, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm explaining something over and over again. They're asking like about all this minutia where, you know, and even some of what you're talking about is minutia in some respect. And like you said, like at some point it doesn't matter in the practical day-to-day living, like in the, maybe the span of humanity, like in where we go from here, it does. But, you know, is there a balance when you enter the business world of how much of Moran Cerf you need to know or versus like, what are the basics I need to keep in mind?
So let me tell you why I'm going to take it even bigger picture and tell you why you're better than me. Why people should listen to you and not to me. When both of us come to a client and try to explain to them how to do things.
Make sure you say this one slowly. Sorry. I could use the business.
I'll tell you. So here's an example. And then and the message would be that they should listen to you more than to me. We spent almost 6 years trying to understand how the eyes look at content and explaining the nuances of what draws your attention and what colors and changes. And we actually found a beautiful algorithm. We call it the saliency model. My PhD advisor basically is known for refining this beautifully. And this says that I can now give you a JPEG and you can predict with this algorithm perfectly where the eyes are going to go. So we were excited about that. We said, here it is. We now can predict what people are going to look at in every content, in a commercial, in a supermarket, in a shelf of a supermarket. Let's go to anyone and offer that as a replacement to any other smart choice they make. So someone I know went with that to New York Times and said, we're going to tell you how to design your page perfectly because we now have this perfect algorithm that predicts what people are going to look at. And if you want people to look at this ad, we're going to tell you what colors to make it and where to put it and everything. And then he came up with that and he showed New York Times how to do it. And they said, you know, it's great that you have this algorithm, but we have Anthony here in the back and he's been doing it for 20 years. And what you spent a lot of time learning and explaining, he just knows intuitively and we rely on him. It takes a lot less time to do it. He's perfect. And in many ways, people like you who spent a lot of time learning this thing, they don't need the science to explain the thought. They just have it intuitively. And I think that more and more we learn that the experts are better than any algorithm. And also, we don't need to explain how the brain works or we just need to have a person who feel it,
right,
do it. And the best marketing people right now and the best traders in finance and the best CEOs, they're just tuned to their brand. They're tuned to their business. And they enjoy me coming and like studying for months how their brain works, how the brand of the audience is, and explaining. But at the end of the day, they don't need me. It's all there. They already know the answer. So this is why you're better.
This is why you're out of a job now. You just everyone listening to the show will never hire. No, just kidding. But I mean, you know, I think people are still intrinsically drawn, you know, to what you do. And I think, you know, whether like if you do a 6-month study for them, I think it's those top level findings that become the things that become a shift. And maybe not like, hey, here's the exact page design layout. But if it's people like this at this time of year because this is the weather and this is XYZ, it's like, okay, that's a great insight. We can build from that.
People like science overall. They, even if they know the answer intuitively, even if there is Anthony in the back, they like a scientist to also explain. And occasionally, and this is where neuromarketing, the field that I'm kind of trying to promote a lot right now, is focusing right now. And it's the realm we're trying to kind of amplify right now are the moments that are where there's difference between what you intuitively want and what neuroscience would tell you. So most of the time, 99% of the time, what we see is that whatever we study is exactly what you get from a person who just tells you. So we study the brains of people who make decisions and we ask them a question and they say, yeah, I wanted this movie because it's more funny than this movie. So, well, okay, fine. I just spent like a decade studying your brain and I write like a mechanism, but you can also articulate it. And the only interesting moments are the moments where the person says, I want A, and we say, no, your brain tells me you want not A, and let's see in 6 months what you're going to buy, A or not A. And every now and then there's some domains where we're better than the person himself, and that's when it becomes interesting. I think that, for instance, one realm that I think is benefiting from that a lot right now is politics, because there's elections coming exactly in a year from now, and the undecided are this kind of group that everyone cares about, And we don't know yet.
Woo, Ben Carson. Woo. Right, right, Sean? Ben, all right, Ben Carson.
So this is like a realm where it becomes interesting. But for most businesses and brands, it's really we're explaining the obvious.
Right.
Right now. But yeah. But I'm still hopeful. And so we only need one time that we do better, then this field is going to kind of have an emergence. But right now we're still struggling on finding this one thing that we do better than just asking Anthony in the back.
As far as your own sort of personal brand story, you know, and like the transitions you've been, there's a moment that you're known for, you know, probably most commonly known for.
Yeah.
And it's you gave a talk on the Moth about one of your bank incidences. I'll spare you telling the story, but, and people please go Google the Moran Surf Moth Grand Slam winner, right?
Yes.
But because you're an amazing storyteller, and you know, how do you feel a need to overcome that? Or, you know, because I feel like we were hanging out last night and there were people coming up to you like, oh, you're that guy, but you're kind of like no longer that guy. So, you know, from a public perception, does that hinder or hurt or help?
So I wish I controlled the moment, and I at the time knew that this is a moment that's going to define my life, so to speak.
But you're just a bishop.
Yeah. That's true. So I think no matter what I do as a scientist, it's been 10 years, I'm going to be known as the guy who broke into a bank, and I'm going to be known as a hacker. I try to now leverage that into part of my narrative and tell my story, and people ask is how I learned things as a hacker that influenced my career as a scientist, and how my career as a hacker tells me something about how brands operate in bad states and how bad behavior can be used, and all kinds of things that I try to leverage. But it's funny that in the world we live in right now, because communication starts with a search on Google,
right,
the thing that pops up is one thing, and I think that I have to explain myself starting with here's why. So I can tell you stories from various domains. I once tried to pass TSA with an experiment setup that I had that actually looked like a bomb. So it was like, the experiment itself required like a something, it looked like a clock.
Right. Wow. Like an old classic bomb. Yeah. It had like a steel ball, yeah, with a wick on it. Just like.
Exactly. Countdown time. And then they say, okay, we have to investigate who this guy is. And they look online. And the first thing that shows up is, you know, TSA. They're making an effort. They're looking online who I am to kind of find reason to let me pass with something. And the first thing that shows up is, now I have to explain two things. Here is why I'm carrying something that looks like a bomb, and also why I'm not really trying to rob a bank. And so I think that this is the good side. But I think on the flip side, or the silver lining in that, is that I feel that this was a story I told at the Moth the first time I went to the Moth. I kind of came, told a story, and started advancing in their kind of hierarchy of from the Moth Story Slam to the Moth Grand Slam. So I didn't know enough about storytelling at the time, and this forced me to be a storyteller. So people ask me since then to tell stories, and I tell my students. And what I learned, I think, is that communication is essential right now to any career you choose. As in, even as a scientist, it used to be that you had enough if you just sat in a little room with a little lamp and wrote equations and submitted a paper and this was it. But I think that right now we live in a world where you aren't just giving a talk, you also write a paper, and you also have to have a TED talk that is very articulated and explains everything that you did in your life in 15 minutes. And you also have to be able to speak to different audiences and simplify it or complicate it. And all of those things are the world we live in right now. So the skill of telling stories and being known as a storyteller is good for science.
Right.
So I'm assuming this position regardless. Can I tell you one more story?
Hey, I'm here.
This is a story that is in my mind right now. As I said, that I thought about that. Last year, I was at Kellogg teaching the marketing class, teaching MBAs how to use neuroscience.
At the cereal factory? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, that was bad. Continue.
And one day, I'm told my class is canceled because President Obama is going to visit Kellogg. So he came and my class was canceled. And all my students went and they allowed the faculty to be there before. But I, of course, forgot to sign up on time. So I wasn't allowed in the room where everyone was meeting the president in my school. But there was a remedy. They allowed those of us who didn't get in to have a evening before meeting with David Axelrod, the senior advisor,
yep,
and with the actor who plays Josh Lyman in The West Wing.
Okay.
Those are the two people.
It's a good consolation prize.
Yeah, exactly. Which, so there's like a small meeting and we get that. And there was a discussion about politics and very interesting kind of evening. And then the actor said something that unfortunately really resonated with me up to today and kind of highlights what I said. He said that in our day and age, you can be president pretty much no matter what you do, but one thing. So you can sleep with your intern, go to war for false reason. You can do whatever you want and you can still remain president, but there's one thing you cannot be president and have, and that is be bad on camera. If you're not good on camera, you can't be president in the US anymore. And he said, this is my job. I'm an actor. I should be good on camera. Presidents aren't supposed to be that. But the reality is that this is the world we live in right now. You
right.
have to be, you have to not just be a good scientist who solves puzzles. You also have to know how to tell a story. You have to have beautiful slides. You have to basically have a brand. And this is where I think marketing is more than just the trying to sell Captain Crunch in a store. It's also who you are and your identity and your brand are working with you anywhere. So now the story that people find when they look me up on Google has to tie into neuroscience research and my identity. And I think that I learned that slowly because I always thought of myself as a scientist but not as a brand, but I realized that this is the case right now. You don't care as much about like the institute the person is. You don't say he's a professor at Kellogg, he's a professor at NYU. You right now say, who is this guy and what can I find about him? And every professor has their website and a brand and no, and that's kind of the world we live in. And it took me a while to adjust, but now I feel that this is the long answer to the question, how I include the fact that I'm going to always be known as a hacker
right.
with me being a professor.
And but it's good because I think, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about this idea of capacity, right? And what a musician would have to do to make it 20 years ago has vastly changed. They have to do so many different things, you know, thus the birth of the multi-hybrid, you know, person, right? The hybridization of humanity, if you will. Wow, that sounds good. You want to write that up for a paper? But as we wind down, I do want to touch on that idea of hybridization because you were at PopTech. We were supposed to be there together. I couldn't make it. But there was a theme at the event. And for those of you don't know, please Google PopTech, but it's a really cool gathering of geeks and smart people and entrepreneurs and different thinkers. But there was a theme of being hybrid.
Yes.
And you had to give a last minute talk on that. Kind of talk about the theme and then where you went with it.
So I love PopTech for many reasons, and I basically say yes to everything they have in mind. Whatever they say, give a talk, train the fellows, everything they say, I always say yes to. So they came to me the night before and they said, tomorrow we want you to give a talk for 5 minutes about something that has to do with hybrid. And the conference was themed hybrid, and pretty much every person who went on stage opened by explaining somehow what makes them a hybrid. So one person's the editor of Esquire magazine spoke about how the past, all of the issues of the past influenced his choices in the present. And a person spoke about being rich and poor and how changing from being poor to being rich actually changed his mindset. And one woman spoke about the changes between love and hate. And everyone kind of started with some kind of opposites and explained how it informed their life. And before I gave my talk, I had about 10 minutes to prepare. And I said, okay, I should also open up by explaining how I am a hybrid. And everything was taken. There was already everything I could think of was taken. The only thing that I saw wasn't taken was being dead and alive, which I didn't think that there's a lot you can do with being dead and alive other than spoke about quantum physics and, you know, Schrödinger's cat and what does it mean to be in a state of, but I couldn't find. But then somehow, miraculously, it dawned on me. And what came back was a story that I remembered from the days as a hacker. Now that I'm telling it in your show, now I'm going to be known for that. Every time when I pass TSA. So if TSA,
right at the end, it's like, yeah, the last part was great, but he's a hybrid guy.
If TSA is now, if I'm right now stopped by TSA and they're trying to figure out who I am, this is just a story. I'm a professor of neuroscience. I'm teaching business school students. This is just an anecdote from the past. Please let me pass with this little box in security. Okay, so now we cleared that. So the story was a story of a period of my life back in the days where I was working as a hacker, where things started being strange. So suddenly I get letters that my SAT that I was supposed to take in a few weeks is canceled. I'm not going to be there. And I started getting letters from insurance companies offering me all kinds of things that were weird, that were un- usual for me because I usually get like one letter by mail, you know, a month. So then I get like 10 a day. And I couldn't put one together at a time. And what happened that eventually is I went to the bank and I tried to get cash from, you know, the cashier because it's the early 2000s when you still have to go inside the bank.
Right.
I go inside and the person there says, sorry, I can give you money. The system won't let me do that. And we try to investigate what could stop me because I knew that I have some money in my checking account. Bottom line, he says, it seems like you're dead. So the system says that you're dead and you died 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago. And we cannot give money to a dead person. And I say, this is ridiculous. Clearly, I'm alive. Like, this is not, what do you mean by that? And they say, we don't know what's going on. And I start to investigate. And what actually happened to be the case, we learned quickly after, was that at the time, my team was working on trying to break into the equivalent of the Social Security Service database. So there is in Israel this kind of system database that has everyone's records, and it has your first name, last name, age, gender, race, whatever you want is in the system, and this is kind of what determines who you are. We were tasked in trying to break into the system. One of my colleagues broke into the system, and then we normally have a video that we show to the company how we did that, and he wanted to show how we can actually change a record. He picked my record, and he changed the flag that indicates that you're alive, 1 to 0, being dead. And then turns out that this system feeds into every system in the country, banks, insurance companies, every other company. And no one ever came back to life other than Elvis Presley, Paul McCartney, and Jesus.
Tupac.
So those are the four people that I knew came back to life. But so they didn't really have a code that updates things. Actually, I think they actually updated back to me being alive, but the system just feeds one way. Like, you don't, no one checks again after you died if you came back to life. So for all purposes, I was dead in every system in the country. And it took us a few days to find ways to change that. I think that what they did in the end is they had a judge allow them to create another entry in the database. And now there's actually two of us. There's the zombie me floating around, and there's the living me in the Israeli.
What time of day did you ask the judge to make that change?
8 a.m. That's the
time. like, hey, before you go in there, I got one tiny favor. I promised you I'd let you off the hook, but I have one last question. Because you said Jesus, and we talked about dead and alive, and I was, my horrible joke is I was that Jesus was the first zombie. But it's true in some circles. However, it's a great comic book, though, right? It'd be a good comic book. When you talk about this idea of choice and, you know, psychology in the brain and neuroscience, and there was an episode of Larry Wilmore's show last night with Neil deGrasse Tyson and Carl Lentz, who's like a superstar, you know, Christian pastor. And it was just like, where does science and religion, you know, where do they intersect, or do they intersect? How much of that choice is faith, you know, in a higher power or not?
Tough. That's a tough one. You're pushing me to my limits of knowledge right now. So here's what I can say. There's people who study happiness, business people who study happiness. It became a good business. I mean, it's going to tie to God.
That's fine.
Trust me. And they try to see. It started by economists. Actually, one of them won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for kind of looking into those questions. And the question was, is making more money going to make you happy? Because people assume this is the case. And the answer is probably not. I mean, some level from 0 to 50,000, it actually makes you happy. But after that, it doesn't make anything. But they actually investigated what makes you happy. And they formulated a number of things that make you happy. And I can give you the list of the top five, but I'll focus on number 3. So number 5 is exercising. So this is not surprising. People who exercise actually are happier. Number 4 is volunteering. So people who do things for others actually get a reward in the form of happiness. Number 3 is being spiritual. Number 2 is being social and interacting with others. And number 1 is interesting because it's way above all the other and it's the most unexpected one. You can try to guess if you want what it is.
Food?
No.
No.
But along the same lines, it's sleep. So of all the things, if you can choose to make $1 million or sleep well for the rest of your life, like wake up not tired, you should choose sleep. It's going to make you much happier. So this is the study. And I was always baffled by number 3. Like, why is spirituality so high up and what about it makes us happy? And I think that the answer to me is that it ties to number 2. Number 2 was being social and interactive. For the brain, things are more interesting in the world when we interact. Communication makes our brain work. It changes our brain the most. It makes us active, and it's actually doing a lot of good things for us. I think the people that are spiritual, not even religious, have someone with them all the time and interact with them. They go to sleep in bed, and there's someone there to interact with. They spend a lot of time kind of calming their brain down and letting voices who are more buried down come back to life. So in a way, they always do this thing. So it doesn't matter if you're religious or not. I happen to not be. But I think in a way, there's a benefit to that that I'm not going to have. Because if I don't believe in God, then I'm not going to have that in many ways. But if you believe in God, you actually have a friend with you all the time, talking to you and interacting with you and making your brain active. And that, I think, is beautiful because it makes your life more rich. And spirituality, and here I'm not separating between being religious or being spiritual. Sure. Anything that brings you this thing is good. And I think this is the one domain where neuroscience, very kind of classic neuroscience, it's very mechanical and very spiritual world intersects, because we know that it affects your brain positively. So that's how I tie spirituality, God, happiness, and money.
I just found your next 10 years. This is where you combine those three things. So the show is called Innovation Crush, as you've been informed. What are some things that you've seen out in the world that you're personally crushing on? They can be in your world or something you've seen recently or experience that you've had.
I thought when we started that I'm going to have to answer that, and I spent a lot of time in my mind racing, trying to think, but I actually have the answer. So I didn't know when you started.
It's not spontaneous.
No, I knew that.
You got notes and everything. You're like the most prepared. You are an academic because nobody else has ever come in here with.
This is just page one of like 20 that I have prepared. I didn't do any of the notes, by the way. Like none of those things that were said. So it's actually good.
What's the first thing on there? What does it say?
Just
read it. You don't have to explain it.
It says decide. It says how far before. It says consumer neuroscience. It says manipulation behavior. It says politics. It says AMC theater. It says YouTube. It says Hershey. It says
weird stuff.
All clients we worked with that cared about. I thought maybe you're gonna ask me about like how AMC theaters chooses how to edit the trailers. So how things like that. That's why I wrote.
I think we got the essence of it, right?
Like we covered more than ever is needed by. And also I speak so fast. I think we got three shows in.
I'm going to cut this up into four episodes. But it's fast and it's still a lot of content. I'll slow it down.
So what's the innovation? So I didn't know what I'm going to say, but now it dawned on me as soon as you asked me that I know what it is. Dreams. I think that the next, combining what I said about sleep, I think that the next domain that is uncharted territory that we're going to change the world with and businesses should focus on right now is sleep. Not just because sleep correlates highly with happiness, and if you make people sleep better, they actually are happier. We also know, and this is the flip side of the same thing, that you sleep for a third of your life. Your consciousness goes to rest if you want when you're sleeping, but your brain still does things. And we can use that to change behavior. So there was a study that came out a few months ago that shows that you can take smokers who want to stop smoking but are unable to, and during the moment in their sleep where the brain is, if you want, listening without waking up, without resisting, you can actually spray the smell of nicotine into their nose, and immediately after spray the smell of rotten eggs and basically make their brain create a pairing that says that smoking is not tasty. And then they wake up the morning after, they don't know what happened overnight, and they drop their amount of cigarettes that they consume by more than a half.
Wow.
So that's now changing behavior for the good. You say, I want to be that. I don't know how to do that. We do things to you when you're asleep and you make you smoke less. We can change racial biases. There's a study that came exactly a few, 6 months ago, I think. So it was sometime around April.
So you're going to sneak into Donald Trump's bedroom?
You can sneak into Donald Trump's bedroom. So it's amazing how fast it works. So you take a person, not just overnight sleep, they bring people, and I think they went with all kinds of simple biases tests. So they try to see how racist you are, black versus white, rich versus poor, women and income,
right.
Women and paycheck. They try to kind of take all kinds of biases that people had. Even if even if you're a woman, you might have biases against equal wages when it comes, just because your society is in your brain.
Yep.
They had those women take a nap. So not like a long sleep, a nap of about 2 hours. During the nap, they target this window, and it doesn't work in the entire night. It works only in a specific window where your brain basically rethinks life in a way, and they injected using sounds. Positive thoughts, if you want, about equal pay. And then they wake these women up and ask them to take the same test they took 2 hours ago. And there's already a change in their biases. So this means that there's something happens in our sleep that we can now tap into. And we can take people and not just, make them less racist and better people and stop them, but we can also maybe start thinking about ways to use that for education. So you can wake up and know Kung Fu. So this to me is like a new domain. It's new. It's about a year old when we kind of start to understand what it's going into. And you can use it for anything, and businesses are now able to, you know, make you go to sleep and wake up wanting the water.
It's like sleep therapy, like almost.
It's like sleep therapy plus the use of brands, right. Plus changing your mind, plus changing behavior. I mean, I think that this is uncharted territory. There's very handful of papers in science that talk about that, and even less companies that know about the results and use them right now. And I think this is an uncharted territory that if I were an entrepreneur right now, I would try to tap into that and do something with that, because I think that there's an enormous amount of things you can do in sleep, and people are going to be willing to let you do that. They're going to say, I'm going to put the alarm clock with smells next to my bed so you can guarantee that I have positive dreams.
Right.
And this is, to me, like exciting, and I'm happy to push that. No,
that's awesome. It's funny. I think I got in a Twitter conversation with this brand called Casper, and they make mattresses. But the way they're going about like selling beds is pretty amazing, right? They're owning sleep in terms of, they did a tour. They had a semi truck where they had four or five beds on the back of a semi, and it was like the side was cut out, and you could go in and book a nap, right? Or they rented an apartment in the Hollywood Hills, and you could go and book sleep time to go there and sleep. And then you look at their website; it's content all like in the tangential to sleep, from pattern to how you wake up to routines you should have in the morning. So, that could be a good brand to sort of tackle it with.
I agree. I think this is an uncharted territory yet. There aren't enough companies doing something with that. And I think that the science shows more and more that it's a useful time of our life that we can do something with.
Or your mattress is free. only a few people will get that joke. this show goes internationally, and that's like a very local commercial. So people will be like, what is he doing? So last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is?
A state of mind where various sides of you are able to come up with new ideas.
Wow. Yeah. How's that feel?
This was innovation. I didn't know I have it in me to come up with like a Wikipedia first line entry.
See, there you go. Well, thank you. We'll have to get you back to finish up your me search a little later. But any final words? You don't have to have them. I'm just asking.
I'm enjoying it tremendously. And I think that you got me to say everything I want to say.
Great. Everyone, this is... Oh, wait. Before we do that, where can people find you? Because your website is a little like academia looking, but I think people will get it.
So I think that somehow, I have a website, and I teach in two different schools across the year. Very messy life, flying around, seeing patients in Los Angeles, seeing patients in New York, teaching MBAs in Chicago. But the reality is that I say yes to everything, unfortunately. So when someone calls me and says, can you fly to Maine and give a talk for 10 minutes in an island in Camden? I say, sure, and I make it. So I think that... my website, moransurf.com, is where people find me. My email is there. They ask me to do something, and I always say yes. So the easiest person to find.
All right. And just for the sake of your accent, are you ever going to take an accent reduction course, or are you just going to let it ride?
This is me after.
He's like, I graduated already. M-O-R-A-N...
C-E-R-F. Yes.
Everyone...
com is a C-O-M.
Yes, yeah, but I think they got it. And there's, you don't actually spell out the word dot. It's actually the period. It's somewhere in the bottom of the keyboard. thank you again. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.